Up at 2017, and as, take, I suppose this as a temporal participle, and as he was going up, he always going up to Jerusalem, and as Jesus was going up into Jerusalem, he took along, par eleban, the 12, and then you can read disciples or not, it doesn't change the meaning substantially at all. He took along the 12 disciples, kat idion, idiomatic for privately. He pulled them aside, and on the way, he said to them, look, this marker idu, which is sort of like hine in the Old Testament, it's actually an aorist imperative middle, but it's just like, hey, listen up. Anabinamen, we are going up into Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests, paradidomi in the aorist, the future passive, will be handed over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him. Here's a good example of what liquid stem verbs do in the future. The only difference, if I'm remembering right, between the present of katakrino and the future indicative active of katakrino is the accent mark, and the circumflex over the oo tells you that this is future, not present. And you thought accent marks didn't mean anything. And they will condemn him to death. That looks odd to me. I have to confess I didn't really search it out. The variant reading looks a little easier, which is probably why it should be regarded as the variant reading. Ace thanaton, I think, down there at the bottom. Yeah, but it's not very well attested. But the sense is tolerable enough, and they will condemn him to death. Verse 19, and they will, after they do that, after the Jewish guys, the chief priests and scribes do that, and they will hand him to the Gentiles, tois ethnizin, for this purpose, ace ta plus a couple of infinitives, three of them in fact. Remember that construction can often express purpose. Purpose, or maybe even result. Either one would work. Maybe result. So that they beat, no, mock and beat or scourge and crucify him. And with a potential or possible nod to Hosea 5 and 6, I'm not convinced in that regard myself one way or the other. And on the third day, dative of time when, he will be raised, eger thesetai. So the first explicit passion prediction is at 1621, and then there's another one in chapter 17, and now this is the third time that Jesus has explicitly predicted his going up to Jerusalem for the purpose of dying and being raised from the dead. Now, the narrative moves on with a story that shows the incomprehension of the disciples. Something new and different, the incomprehension of the disciples. Verse 20, then, the mother, Hamater, of the sons of Zebedee, pros elthund to him, approached him, with the sons of her, you could stretch these two participles to express purpose, in order to worship and ask something, or maybe just, what I learned just last week, Veltz calls these might be bang-bang participles. That is, you just approach and you do it, you know. So you can translate them either way. She approached and worshipped reverenced, and she asked something, ap autu, from him. And he said to her, what do you want? What do you wish? And she says to him, ape, aorist imperative, say or speak. Now we have a hina clause, and after a verb of speaking like this, it's probably not purpose, but simply indirect discourse like a hati clause. Say that, hutoi hoi dia huioi mu, these two sons of me, these my two sons, may sit or will sit, kathizozin, haste. Ex dexionsu, one out of your rights, this is just idiomatic, and one out of your lefts, in your basileia, in your kingdom. Now she has in mind, of course, some sort of eschatological glory, right? And Jesus has just promised, you know, at the end of chapter 19 in In verse 28, he says to the 12, you will sit on 12 thrones and judge the 12 tribes of Israel, right? So he just said that. Well, I think that's what's in her mind. Well, I want my two sons to have the two top spots, right? One on your right, one on your left. And there's lots of evidence from the ancient world that this is what right and left mean in her thinking. You know, I want one to be the vice president, the other to be the secretary of state, or however you'd express it in modern terms. In your basileia, but she doesn't understand the nature of the basileia. She doesn't understand the nature of the kingdom or of greatness and primacy. This is a great text for an ordination, by the way. And answering, Jesus said, "Uk oideta te aitesta, you don't know what you are requesting." And notice that he's switched to the second person plural. He's not talking to the mother, he's talking to the sons, right? Mark, by the way, doesn't have the mother at all in the scene. Mark goes, he cuts to the chase and realizes that it's James and John who are doing the real asking here. You don't know what you are asking. Are you able to drink, complimentary infinitive, the paterion, the cup which I am about to drink? A serious duh moment in the scriptures here. They say to him, we are able. I mean, this is great. Yeah, right. 23, he says to them, and this is ambiguous, we'll come back to this. On the one hand, the cup of me, my cup, you will drink. But on the other hand, the to sit on my rights and on my lefts is not mine in order to give. The sense is tolerably clear. This fact of giving the places on my right and left isn't mine. I'm not supposed to do it. But, and you have to supply, you know, the antecedent of the relative pronoun hois, just the way you often do in the New Testament. But it's for the ones to whom, there's the hois, to whom it stands prepared by the Father of me, the ones for whom it has been prepared by my Father. Now, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here, and I think some of it's fairly certain and some of it's a little less certain. But I just happened to read an article last week by this fellow Dale Allison, who's co-authoring this huge commentary on Matthew with W.D. Davies. And I think he's quite right. St. Matthew intends, as you continue to read the gospel, I think it can be argued, and I think it's right, to say that when you get to Jesus' crucifixion, okay, where he is crowned, ironically, they don't know it's right, as the King of the Jews, and they crucify one on his right and one on his left, that the reader is supposed to remember this story and say, that's what they were asking for. Right? In other words, here is the king in his basileia, right? Dying on the cross. Here he sits, in, if you will, enthroned, right? And that's why Jesus says, you don't know what you're asking. You can marry that with, there's a couple of things, that obvious things that support it. One is he's just predicted his passion, right? He just said that's where he's going. Another is our theology of the cup that Jesus drinks, right? Commentators are notoriously wishy-washy in this regard. I mean, it's astounding to me, and good conservative people sometimes too. Jesus in the garden, you know, let this cup pass from me. They typically call it the cup of suffering. They may go so far as to call it the cup of death. Okay, I think, see the forthcoming, yes, finally, forthcoming commentary on Obadiah by the anonymous Paul Rabbi, and he has this extensive excursus on the metaphor in the Old Testament of drinking the cup of God's wrath. See, I think that's the cup. Jesus says in the garden, this cup. I think he's talking about the cup of God's wrath. See? So, and he drinks that on the cross, right? So, are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink? We're able. No, you're not. Now, see, that brings up a problem, though, because then Jesus does say, you will drink my cup. And there are two ways to go on this. I've thought for years that it's a reference to the cup of the blood of Jesus, which is being poured out for the forgiveness of sins. That once again, precisely because later on in the story, the reader encounters the Last Supper and Jesus says, take and drink, this is my cup, which is being, it's a present participle, is being poured out for you for the forgiveness of sins. That in fact, is, granted it's oblique, and you'd have to say that Jesus is saying something that they'll only get later, that's all right, that he's referring to that cup when he says, you will drink my cup. Now, theologically, I think it can be defended exegetically. I think also theologically and homiletically, it is absolutely magnificent. Because when the cup hits his lips, it's filled with wrath. He drains it to the dregs, and by the time it gets to our lips, it's not the cup of wrath, it's the cup of salvation. Right? I mean, and we're Lutherans, and we go, right? Now, the other way you can go on this, and this would be supported by New Testament, other New Testament statements, like you'd have to go outside of Matthew for sure. Well, you could support it with carrying the cross. You know, you could do it that way. And Paul, you know, completing in his own sufferings, the sufferings of Christ, you know, so that Jesus may be saying here, you will participate in my sufferings because you belong to me, you know, and somehow theologically work that out. And that, you know, you could do it that way too. And that's actually the way most people go with it. But once you make the connection, the paradox of kingdom and the king enthroned on the cross, and once you insist that the cup which he's going to drink is the cup of wrath, not just the cup of suffering, see, then I think it's defensible to go with the cup that they get is the cup that we offer, you know, on the Lord's Day, which is no longer filled with wrath, but because he drank the wrath of God, it's filled with blessing. So, yeah, John, and then go ahead. Yeah, I've thought about that. Right, right. Those who don't discern the body and don't eat and drink worthily. Yeah, you could. I'm not sure I'd do it if you were preaching on this text. That's more of a 1 Corinthians move, but I mean, it's, yeah, you're right. It's connected, right? Well, at that point, you'd have to sum it up the level one statements of 1 Corinthians. I mean, you couldn't answer that question just on the basis of this. Right, right. At that point, your theologizing has to be informed by a different text than this one. Wait, say the two statements again.
Or a certain understanding of all one first Christians, that some Christians can drink the cup of wrath.
Right.
Which would have some theological implications as far as what it means to be free from the cup of wrath.
Right.
Or we're saying that this can't apply to the world.
Right. We'll see. No, not necessarily, because the contexts are radically different, and besides which, drinking the cup in Corinth unworthily is not drinking the wrath of God. It's inviting the judgment of God, but not his, precisely not his katakrinoing, only his krisis. So, yeah, again, I think that would be an example of where you'd want to let the level one statements of 1 Corinthians govern where you go and not let this text govern on that particular issue. But, yeah. At any rate, I do think, I mean, and again, this is a wonderful example of how, I mean, if a person were really disciplined and you didn't have any administrative duties and you weren't even the acting president of anything, you'd have time to do this. Here, this is Johannine theology. I mean, it's obvious in John. It's a little more subtle in Matthew. But, and John doesn't, I mean, Matthew doesn't use doxa, he doesn't use hypsao. He doesn't use doxazo to get this job done, but it's the same theology, do you see? I mean, this is, it's a magnificent move. Both Matthew and John do it, that is, you know, glory in death, exaltation in humiliation, right? So it's the gospel But it's so exciting to be able to see specifically how Matthew does it. And John, again, it's the same result, but the process is slightly differently, exegetically anyway. So, for instance, a student was trying to work doxazo in Matthew and get to where you could get to it with John. The answer is no. Don't work that word group in Matthew. Work that word group in John. Okay, but there's different words that you can use in Matthew to get ultimately to the same theology, which is sort of what we'd like to do at the end anyway, is to say that all the Gospels have a congruent theological posture. We got to get going here. Verse 24. There's more good stuff, right? And when they had heard, the ten got all aufgeregt. That's the translation of agnakteo, about the two brothers. And Jesus, calling them, he called them and he said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles, or maybe of the nations, doesn't matter too much here, they katakyrieuo all the time. They typically lord it over them, takes a genitive object. And the great guys, to use the Bartiltian phrase, would this be the big guys? Right? The great ones exercise authority over them, again in the genitive. Now this is great. It will not be so among you. I don't think this is an imperative, it's a statement. And the reason why it will not be so is because Jesus is about to redefine greatness and primacy. Once you've redefined the terms, then by definition, if you exercise authority, you are not great. By definition, if you lord it over someone, you are not great. I mean, that's a very postmodern move on the part of the Son of God. He has changed the meaning of the words. But, hoseantele, whoever wishes among you great to become will be of you the servant. And whoever wishes among you to be first will be of you the slave. And now the great punchline, hosper, just as the Son of Man did not come for this purpose. I mean, this is a nice play on grammar here. I mean, it's identical verb, different voice, right? Aorist, infinitive, passive, and aorist, infinitive, active, right? He did not come for the purpose of being served, but for the purpose of serving and dunai, giving the life of him, predicate accusative, as a litron on T, yes, substitutionary vicarious language in exchange for, in place of, the many. I mean, this is sort of, this is gospel by the truckload here in verse 28. It's a little obvious. Nobody can miss it. Well, I suppose you could. But so the Lord roots this new reality, this redefinition of terms in his own work. Right? This is why greatness is so redefined. It's because of the great one, the greatest one, who comes for this purpose, not for that purpose. Right? So, I mean, it's like, how many sermons are here? I don't know, 12, 15, you know. But just terrific for the Lenten journey, right? So, I mean, you have law, call to repentance, right? The times when we confuse and misunderstand the nature of our life and so by implication reject or deny or give the lie to Jesus' own life because we are his. So there's law, and then there's obviously sweet, undeserved, gracious gospel. And yeah, great text. Questions, comments? Yeah, please. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, at that moment.
Yeah, right.
Okay,
right.
I'm going to sacrifice. Okay, no problem. Okay. Good. Anything else? Oh, I see what it is.
One of those excited Hosea.